I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station.
And good afternoon and welcome to A Public Affair here on WORT. My name is Norman Stockwell and I'm your host today for the hour. And today on the program, we're going to be speaking with historian Gar Alperovitz and his brand new book, America Beyond Capitalism. But first, before we get to that, we're going to be getting a live update from the Capitol building where WRT News Director Molly Stentz is currently there. And Molly, are you with us?
Hi, Norm. Good to be with you.
Glad to have you with us. Tell us what exactly is going on at the Capitol today and what occasions you're being there.
So right now there is a solidarity sing-along happening at the Capitol Rotunda, as they have been doing every day from noon to one for many, many, many weeks. Today's has a particularly high attendance. I would say there are maybe 200 people there between the rotunda floor and the first floor overlooking it. It's a little hard to estimate because there is a gigantic Christmas tree in the rotunda now, or a holiday tree if you prefer. And today is significant because the assembly rules, the new rules for the Capitol, have gone into effect that the Department of Administration has put down, which would require groups of more than four people to get a permit in order to have a demonstration at the Capitol. And clearly we have more than four people today here for the same purpose, which is to sing and express themselves. And there's banners being dropped from the rotunda. There's We Shall Overcome was the first kind of opening song that the singers have been singing, and so far there are some police presence, but not heavier than normal, and there had been a question about whether there would be a confrontation, whether the Department of Administration would choose to crack down on this event, which is basically a group of peaceful singers, and it appears that that's not going to happen right now. And standing with me, I have Stacey Harbaugh, who is the communications director of the ACLU. They had an announcement earlier today, and I'm going to put you on the horn with Stacey for just a minute, and she can give you the breaking news update. Here's Stacey.
Hello, thanks, Molly, and thanks to WORT listeners. This is Stacey Harbaugh, the spokesperson for the ACLU of Wisconsin, and we were a host of a press conference earlier today where we answered questions from media and from activists about the future of the newly amended Department of Administration rules over Capitol access. Late last week, the DOA did issue some amendments, but we feel that they aren't going far enough in terms of respecting the First Amendment rights of people who want to gather and sing or protest at our state capitol. Now, as you know, our state capitol is a very unique building. You know, it's a public forum. You know, they say it's the people's building, and it truly is. And this is the only place where you can go to legislators where they work and voice your opinion, to be a part of a crowd, to hold signs, and to participate in that democratic process. And so this space is very important, and that's why we have to do what we can to protect First Amendment rights here at the Capitol. Molly, do you have any questions for me, anything you want me to address for the listeners today?
Talk about what has changed. What have you lost back?
Well, and, you know, we think that the Department of Administration is hearing our concerns. The fact that they did issue some amendments was progress. We still have a ways to go. But in the meantime, the ACLU of Wisconsin's Board of Directors did authorize us to take an appropriate legal action. However, we're still trying to just send feedback to the Department of Administration to let them know what still needs to be changed. They really need to go back to the drawing board with that. In the meantime, the ACLU of Wisconsin will continue to organize volunteer legal observers. We have about a half a dozen witnesses that are out there today, and their whole job is just to watch the protests, to document what happens, and really just to watch for any interactions between protesters and police. We don't expect there to be any problems today. We don't expect there to be tickets or arrests for constitutionally protected First Amendment activity, but we'll be there and we'll be watching. So if there are any organizations that feel like they may be stifled from these new rules, if they don't have the income or the internal structure to be able to pay for their permit and liability scheme that they have set up, then they're welcome to contact the ACLU of Wisconsin and tell us their story. We're really busy at the ACLU these days, but First Amendment rights are sacred, and we need to do everything we can to protect them. And there are a lot of people who are in the rotunda today who are exercising those rights, and we're here and we're watching. So thank you so much for the opportunity to be on the air, and, you know, great space. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stacy and Molly, for those updates. Do we anticipate anything else going on today? How long will the singers be there, and what else do you think will be happening in the rotunda today?
Hi, Norm. The singers will be here until 1. That's their general procedure each weekday from noon to 1. Maybe people will stay later today. That's not clear. There's definitely more banners today and a lot more people than you find on an average Solidarity sing-along day. They're singing Christmas carols now with adapted words. I can let you get a little taste of that and then let you go.
Well, as listeners can hear in the background, there's quite a crowd there singing in the rotunda of the Capitol in spite of today's implementation, or at least announced implementation of new rules for Capitol access. Thanks very much to Molly Stenz coming to us live from the Capitol Rotunda and bringing us an update also from the ACLU of Wisconsin with Stacey Harbaugh. Thank you very much.
No problem, Norm. Take care.
You are listening to A Public Affair, a brief little musical interlude from David Rovics, and we will be right back with our guest, Gar Alperovitz.
Because this is where they buy the politicians. Because this is where power has its seat. Because 99% of us are suffering at the mercy of the madmen on this street. Because all of us are victims of class warfare being waged on us by the 1%. Because these greedy banksters rob the country, leaving us without the means to pay the rent. Because the last time that we had a decent government was about 1932. Because we the people are supposed to run this country, but instead it's all run by and for the few. Because now we know the rich do not pay taxes, but when they need a hand, it's us who bail them out. Because we suspected we lived in a plutocracy, but suddenly of late there is no doubt, so we're gonna stay.
And a little bit there of an anthem of the Occupy Wall Street movement to kick off our program today. You're listening to A Public Affair. I'm very, very pleased to have with us on the phone Gar Alperovitz, author of the brand new reissue of a book that originally came out about 5 years ago, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Welcome to WORT.
Good. Thanks for having me. Pleased to be here.
Very pleased to have you with us, and also you get to hear that update from the Capitol here in Wisconsin, which I know many people have said that things that started here in Wisconsin have rippled through the Occupy Wall Street movement. This book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy, the printed new edition of it from the Democracy Collaborative Press and Dollars and Cents magazine. It was kind of a pretty prescient book that you wrote in 2005 at the sort of the middle of the George W. Bush administration, before the housing bubble, before the stock market crash. And yet in that book, if I can just find this little quote here I was going to read, you talk about the beginning phases of what can only be called a systematic crisis, an era of history in which the political economic system must slowly lose legitimacy because the realities it produces contradict the values it proclaims. And how did you in 2005 sort of presage, if you will, what happened from 2008 through the Occupy Wall Street movement of today?
Well, let me speak to that question, but first I want to say it's great to be back. I'm from Wisconsin and went to the university, and so hearing that from the Capitol just was wonderful. So that's background. I think anyone who's studied the emerging economic and both political trends, and that's what I was trying to do when the book came out at the height of the Bush era, it seemed obvious that growing inequality on the one hand, the financial buildup on the other, and the stalemate in doing serious reform programs was drawing towards great difficulty. That it could not go on very much longer was my judgment. I rarely have been in a position of kind of predicting an outrising of some kind, which comes later in the book, but it turns out that things happened in a way that came faster than I thought. The other is the long trends on really fundamental things: equality, liberty, democracy, ecological sustainability. They've all been sliding down for a long time, and that simply cannot go on much longer before people wake up, both to the economic pain and the social pain, but also to the contradiction of, really profound values that people hold dear. That woman from the Civil Liberties Union was really wonderful. And liberty is at stake here. And, people know that directly from what Governor Walker has tried to do in terms of denying people both their democratic rights and their liberty. So those trends are, people at some level sense deeply that what's happening in Washington and the way the corporations and the lobbyists dominate so much, and money dominates elections, that's a fundamental violation of democracy. So at the level of values, and which we don't normally talk about in that way, but historically that can't go on much longer, and simultaneously growing economic pain and social and economic pain because things are getting worse, I think those two things are coming together. I mean, one other point about, I think the whole tone of the Occupy movement, which is truly democratic in a tone, kind of is the other side of that, reflecting this hunger for a reaffirmation of profound rights and also a challenge to the bankers and the Wall Street and the financial interests who are controlling so much. So those two things coming together, I think, is where the real power is and likely to continue over time.
You know, it's interesting. One question that comes to mind is, why not till now? Why was there no Occupy Wall Street before? We've certainly seen, the money funneling up. We see, the top executives making, 300 to 400 times, what the average worker makes, as opposed to the 3 to 4 times that it was back in the early part of the last century. And we see the rise of, big business influence in politics, the Koch brothers most recently coming to the national attention, but obviously all through the early part of the century. Why no Occupy Wall Street before this year?
Well, I think it's hard to answer that in any serious way, but people, I think the pain levels have been growing, if you look at the statistics, on no significant change in real wages has gone on. Inequality has increased dramatically over time. The latest figure on the inequality of income, which is so hard to grasp that it's almost unbelievable, but it is accurate. 400 individuals with more income than the bottom 60% of the society, the bottom 60%, 400 people and more income than the bottom 60%. Those numbers are, that's in the background. Probably the catalytic moment was, on the one hand, these huge bribes that pay off to the bankers who then use the money to give themselves big bonuses. At the same time, the 2009 recession and collapse hit everybody hard. that probably came together at the right time and precipitated a possibility that, that the occupations had begun to teach us was a real opportunity.
It's interesting, in the introduction to this second edition, you talk about events of just the last year or so, last 2 years now, and you note that Franklin Roosevelt attacked the economic royalists and built and mobilized his political base. Obama entered office with an already organized base and largely ignored it. And I think that is now he and his administration are now reaping sort of the fallout from the fact that they did ignore the base. We saw the Occupy movement in Iowa occupying the Obama headquarters.
Yeah, I think that's that they made a political choice to go hire, you know, the people that they hired were the Wall Street people to run, essentially people who were deep into the Wall Street business community or consulting or the Federal Reserve Bank of New York to run their economic policy. That was a decision the president made. And they actively discouraged, they not only ignored the movement, they actively discouraged it. I've talked to some of the leaders of the, for instance, the Campaign for America's Future, which is a very progressive national organization, who desperately tried to get them to realize it would be in their interests to move in the right direction. But a decision was made that they wanted to go the other way, and I think a tragic decision, really, that we've all paid for.
My guest is Gar Alperovitz. The book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Gar Alperovitz is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative, author of numerous books and a brand new edition of America Beyond Capitalism just out from Democracy Collaborative Press and the folks at Dollars and Cents magazine, who have also been guests on this program over the years. The book you refer to as kind of a toolkit. I mean, you wrote this again in 2005, but it's as useful today as it was 6 years ago when it first came to press, and you talk about some of the alternatives, some of the things that we can build that will take America beyond capitalism, but also beyond sort of the old models of state socialism. And of course, the example that comes most readily to mind is the planned economy of the Soviet Union, the planned economy of Cuba before the special period. In these models, you offer solutions, things that we as Americans can move towards that are in some ways sort of uniquely American. And yet some of the models themselves are seen elsewhere in the world. And the first one I think of is Mondragon in Spain.
Yes. Well, the I should just mention the reason we did a new issue of the book, obviously, is that the moment called for it. It was really time to talk about at the height of the so-called Bush boom, people's interest in an America beyond capitalism was less than it is now. So we brought it out very quickly with Dollars and Cents and because of that and because of the occupations and hunger for what can we do. And the book is filled with, the reason I called it a toolkit, the book is filled with literally hundreds of on-the-ground things that are being done in the United States today that point in a different direction. And I want to come to Mondragon from that, but let me mention first, for instance, the central feature of, you want to change the system, changing the system means changing really who owns the productive capital. In capitalism, in traditional free enterprise capitalism, it was really small businessmen dominated that. But in corporate capitalism, the kind we have, it's large corporations that control the large share with very, very heavy ownership by the top 1%, owning just about 50% of the capital, 1% of the society. Those are medieval numbers as well, 1% owning half of the investment capital, just under. So anything, a democratic alternative of any kind, would democratize the ownership of the productive resources. State socialism tried to do it by putting that ownership in the state in a highly centralized way. And that really was, there were problems with that all along, that many on the left and some anarchist community and the libertarian socialist community and the democratic socialist really challenged that model from that side. as did the conservatives, saying it was violating of the principles of liberty. And all of those people, including the conservatives, had a point. The alternative is starting at the ground up and beginning step by step, changing the ownership of productive capital in a kind of a very American way, and certainly a Wisconsin way. For instance, co-ops. You know, I'm from Racine, and co-ops were all around. A very conventional idea, but it is a democratized way at a decentralized basis of owning the productive wealth. There are 130 million Americans, 40% of the society, who are members of one or another kind of co-op, including the credit unions. Now, that's not a marginal experience, though we haven't found a way yet to build on the principles that people take for granted. It's like speaking prose. So that's one example. There are also, about 13 million people involved in one or another kind of worker-owned company. Again, another way to change who owns capital. We can go on later in the discussion. There are state banks and other things, but that's the kind of picture, building from the ground up and then moving steadily, as in the progressive era. So many of the laws that became the New Deal started in Wisconsin and other states, and then they were later projected to larger issues at the national level. And that's the kind of model, that vision of change in a painful period of history, that's behind this book. And the book is a toolkit in the sense it goes through many, many options on the ground that the press simply doesn't cover, that people are doing now that you can replicate in any city or any state around the country.
And Mondragon. Before we do Mondragon, because you've touched on a bunch of different points that I had wanted to delve into, and so let's hold Mondragon for a moment. And let's start with credit unions, because just this past month we saw a huge transfer of wealth from private banks to credit unions in the week leading up to Bank Transfer Day, November 5th. Something like $4.5 billion, I think, or something was the figure.
Yeah, that's the number, $4.5 billion. That's a lot of money.
And what kind of impact has that had on the industry?
Well, I think I don't see yet that has changed the industry, but it has two. When I wrote a piece on this, which was published in Truth Out, got more responses, 3 million likes than anything I'd ever written. And what I suggested was that's the beginning point is transfer your money to some democratic form, usually a credit union. But the next point is to realize that credit unions are democratic organizations. They exist, one person, one member, one vote. We often forget that. We just take it for granted. Many credit unions don't do anything interesting with the money, but they certainly could if people took advantage of their rights. The way you go to the Capitol and say, we're citizens there, we are also citizens if we're members of a credit co-op, you could turn some of that investing to local development, to local co-ops, to local worker-owned firms, to developing ecologically green industries. That's the sort of thing that's possible. And in a way, I call the article, change where you put your money, but also change the system, in the sense building a new institution, the credit union, and transforming it through democratic processes to invest in the kinds of things, these worker-owned firms and co-ops and other things that are already on the ground and building up that sector. So changing the system with those kind of tools that we already have access to, that we haven't been using and need to begin to use.
Now, one of the things that people worry about with credit unions is they don't have the same services as a bank might have. In fact, I saw somebody posted on Facebook the other day, who's using a credit union and what services do they have and how is that different from my bank? And there's also the question of security, the insurance of those funds. I am personally a big proponent of credit unions. I have my money in a credit union. We have our money here at the station in a credit union. But I also had an experience back in the early 1970s of having money in a credit union in Chicago that went under and everybody got back, 60 cents on the dollar or something. What about the safety of funds in a credit union and the services that they're able to provide their members?
Well, it's very rare that they go under, but it is an occasional event. Again, it's an area where pushing forward. And that's why there's still 130 million people involved, basically, because it's so rare. But pushing forward and demanding the kind of protection that you give to other banks certainly is an activist step to make the credit unions a better form of that. But I think it's a marginal problem because they've been operating extremely conservatively in most cases, and it has not. In fact, this is one of the very first ones I've heard of in a long, long time. The one you just mentioned.
Yeah, it was the Hyde Park Credit Union, if you want to look it up. Anyway,
sure.
The other thing that's happening here in Wisconsin in relation to credit unions is there's been a recent change in the law that now allows credit unions to be dissolved and turned into banks. And there's a lot of protest around this. It's a state some of the changes that our Governor Walker has been pushing through. But I don't know if you've heard about that and know anything about the status of that.
I don't know the Wisconsin situation, but there was a national attempt to do something like that about 5 years ago, and the credit unions got together and really beat it back because they had much more citizen support. So, again, any of these institutions, credit unions, we could go through the list, can be turned to almost any purpose. The question is, that's why citizen engagement is critical. They are an instrument that we can engage and use properly and build political support for and improve the regulatory status and the loan guarantees and so forth, or not. If not, they will be certainly turned in a different direction. But they exist and are available to citizen activity, and then they can be used for a new purpose.
We're speaking with Gar Alperovitz. The book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy, just out, a new edition, just out in paperback from the Democracy Collaborative Press and Dollars and Cents magazine. And Gar Alperovitz is with us for the hour. We have a caller on the line, so I want to go to that phone now, and then I'd like to talk about worker ownership. But first, let's go to the phone. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Norman. I guess, first of all, a quick question. I can take my answer afterwards. I was interested in your story about being in a credit union where you weren't completely reimbursed when it went under. Was the credit union federally insured, or was it state insured? Or I'm just curious what the story was there. And also, I'm a little concerned about the optimism with which your guest is speaking of credit unions, at least the ones that are in this country. In Madison, of course, is generally regarded as the capital of the credit union movement, both nationally and internationally. And I'm aware that the main trade union for credit unions, the Credit Union National Association, or CUNA, essentially takes the same stance as the American Bankers Association on matters such as stiffening of bankruptcy laws, and also on the weakening of the powers of any new consumer protection agency for consumers and users of financial products. So I think those are things to be aware of. And as far as the control of credit unions, as an example, the credit union that I belong to, almost entirely the management, almost the entire board of the credit union I belong to is represented by managers from the insurance arm of the Credit Union Association. That would be CUNA Mutual Insurance Group. And while we speak of CUNA Mutual Insurance Group, I'd like to point out that that's a company that for many years had a policy of attempting to break up the union there, and it employed a professional union-busting thug attorney right out of the 19th century. So I don't think that credit unions are necessarily the bastion of progressivism that that you speak of, and I think that sobering fact we have to keep very closely in mind. And there also, I guess one more quick question. I usually like to raise the issue of where do we go from here? I mean, I think everything you're saying is correct, but the question is how do we proceed? And I don't know if uttering the magical incantation of Mondragon is necessarily the answer, nor do I think it's setting up a separate alternative economy. I think we have to challenge and take on the main economy. Otherwise, I don't think we'll ever see any change. And so I guess I've gone on long enough, but I'd be interested in your opinions on these various points. And thanks for taking the call.
Okay, thank you for that call. And my guest, Gar Alperovitz, the book America Beyond Capitalism.
Oh, good questions. All of them are good questions. The first thing as to credit unions, as to democracy and credit unions, take a look at state government. if you look the other way, as we did in the last election, the forces of corporate power will take it over and use it for its own purposes. The right to vote gives you the power to take it back if you act. And if you don't act, you can bet they're going to go in a conservative way. You can't do that with the banks. They are privately owned corporations. You can move your money out, but you can't control them. Credit unions are open to assault by citizen activists who want to move those funds in a different direction. I think he's entirely right. There are many conservative, cautious, and very conservative credit union operators. That doesn't mean that that institution, which is a powerful institution, is not open to political and challenged by activists who want to use it in a different way. I'm not a utopian. I'm a historian. When you look back at the progressive era, the populist era, the prehistory of major change, it almost always looks like you can't do anything because the other guys control the institutions. Think of the women's movement with no votes. Think of the black movement, civil rights movement with no votes, not even access. You have to be, you want to do this, it's an activist game. But look at the institutions available to transformation if you want to. These are not closed doors. What's holding us back is our own inaction. So that's one sentence. What I think is interesting about the current time is that the pain levels are driving people to think about this in very different ways and are likely, there is an opening to begin to say, hey, it's time to do something different and not let this go on and begin looking for the places where there may be inroads. We can talk a lot, I think we will talk probably more in this discussion about worker-owned companies and community development corporations. You know, 25% of American electricity is now produced in a socialist form, public utilities and co-ops, 25%. So at the ground level, there is a lot out there that people don't know about, which over time, it particularly given the pain, and this is the argument of America Beyond Capitalism, can be built up and made into, with political action and political support, the preconditions of many things at the state and local level. Now, I think he's absolutely right about the larger industry. Look, we just had a crisis and took over General Motors and Chrysler. We nationalized them. So we know that when the next financial crisis comes, or the one after that, possibilities for dealing with much larger firms are going to be available. And I think they have to be built up. The problem is we haven't yet developed a vision, practical vision, one that makes sense locally. And I'm from Racine, Wisconsin, and I can explain to the kids I went to high school with, that actually begins to generate a vision at the ground level of what communities could look like, building on what we know and getting active about it, and at the state and then the regional level, and then using those kinds of decentralized ownership of capital principles to also inform a larger, what do you do about large industry, which inevitably has to be a much larger at the public level. I wrote an article in The Nation about a year ago saying, for instance, we know we ought to be building mass transit vehicles and high-speed trains. There's almost no capacity in American industry to do that. We'd get the French or the Japanese or the Chinese or the Germans or Spaniards to come and build here. At some point, when we decide to do that, a whole new industry will be created. Taxpayers will pay for all of it along with the commuters. Who should own an entirely new industry? And my proposal was it ought to be national ownership, public enterprise, jointly with workers and communities in the places where the plants are, so that we build a new model that is not totally centralized as in old state socialism, but also incorporate a radically decentralized community and worker-based vision. And we did the same thing as that in the steel industry at Youngstown in 1977. There were big proposals that people put forward that had new vision. In some ways, it's a very old vision, but it's an attempt in America to begin to see, look around, you can use what's on the ground if you begin to get active politically to generate something that is well beyond traditional state socialism and certainly beyond corporate capitalism, and at least we need to get our own thinking around that kind of set of ideas. I think otherwise we're left saying, what can you do? There's nothing to do, or we're back in the old traps of active explosions that just end up as, they illuminate things, but nothing changes in terms of the long trends.
And I want to ask you, Gar Alperovitz, about the Youngstown steel story, which you were very involved in, the worker buyout of a plant that basically closed and left people standing in the streets with no options. And you note in the introduction to the book that in some ways that was some of the model that's being built on in Cleveland today, and you just touch on that a little bit, and so I'd like to have you talk about that as well.
Well, it's actually a wonderful question following the last question, because here's the pattern of evolutionary understanding and action in Ohio kind of illustrates one way to think about longer-term change, one way. There are many other ways. So this was 1977 when Youngstown Sheet and Tube, the big steel company in Youngstown, went down and 5,000 people got pink slips on one day. In 1977, that was a big deal. There were no big closings like that. That was national news, big headline news. Every major television station was out there. Now it happens every day. But then the local steelworkers and the local ecumenical coalition, the church rounded up a lot of folks, and the churches and synagogues got together and said, this will destroy our town. We've got to have an alternative. And one of the steelworkers came up with the idea, local steelworkers came up with the idea, why can't we run this thing? Why can't we take it over and run it? So a plan was put together. I was involved as one of the chief economic planners. Staunton Lynn was involved, and we put forward a vision and a plan, a very detailed plan with the help of experts, for how you could run that mill. And we had two objectives. One was to actually do it, and the other was to educate people around the country and around Ohio. Why not? Why can't we do this? So it got a huge amount of publicity and, importantly, taught a lot of people some ideas. The Carter administration agreed to put in $200 million in loan guarantees. And then after the election of 1978, the Carter administration pulled back, probably we are told, because the major steel corporations and the international union strongly opposed it. Not the locals, the international. So two things happened. In the state of Ohio, the idea that worker ownership was a possibility was dramatized by this. And over the next 20 years or 25 years, numerous worker-owned companies were set up in Ohio in particular, and in Kent State University, a professor set up a center to help this, which became a technical assistance center, and the idea of worker ownership in Ohio is very common now because of this. And people learned how to do it, so that's another historical development. More recently, and by the way, the steel workers over 30 years have changed their position. They are now in favor. There's been an evolution in the steel workers. They now support worker ownership as an international. So there's been change on the ground in the ideas. There are many new worker-owned companies in Ohio. There are people who know about it. And the steelworkers' union has changed. So that's the kind of evolution which led to, you mentioned the Cleveland development. There's a really interesting lesson of what you can do in America today to change and democratize the ownership of production built on this developing historical process. In Cleveland, in a very poor community of about 40,000 within the center of the city, average income is about $18,000 for a family of four, really poor, largely black. There has been established through a complex organizing process a series of integrated worker-owned co-ops and a revolving fund to refinance them in that city. And these are not little co-ops. This is a large-scale, industrial-scale, green, ecologically advanced laundry. There's a solar installation company and a weatherization company. There's a new hydroponic greenhouse structure with solar heating and some windmill advances in it that can produce 3 to 5 million heads of lettuce a year. And they're putting up two new companies a year at minimal, maybe three or four, is their developing plan. And they're all worker co-ops, but they're linked together because the goal is not to make just a few workers rich. They're linked together with a nonprofit corporation to benefit the community itself, and the companies can't be sold out. They are community building. The workers own them, and they have shares in it. They will get $65,000 in 6 years if they retire. They vote on what they want to do. but they can't leave because the central group helps finance them, and there's revolving fund, and the whole purpose of this is not simply to make a few people rich, but to rebuild a vision of community and community/worker ownership. So it's a variation on the Youngstown model. One of the ways it works, and here's another piece that's very important, in many cities, and again, the theme here is taking advantage where you can and building in a new direction. So in this particular neighborhood in Cleveland, the big hospitals and universities in that area, there are three or four of them, the most famous is the Cleveland Clinic, they purchase, and this is true in many areas, they purchase $3 billion in goods and services a year. That's in addition to salaries and in addition to construction, $3 billion. None of it from the area. So they've agreed, in part, to purchase from these worker-owned co-ops, this whole set, this complex of co-ops that are worker-owned, and they've agreed, in part, to use their purchases to help grow the markets and to shelter them. There's no subsidy. The prices, they have to compete, be competitive, but there is a gain to build in the local area and rebuild the community. So think about another piece of this. It's not only worker ownership and cooperatives and community building. Hospitals and universities are heavily public in terms of their money sources, Medicare, Medicaid, student aid, public support of universities. That's a large part of that is public money. So there is a reason to begin to say, hey, the public wants you to use that money in a way that builds a very different model. So that's a very interesting model on the ground in America today, and a number of cities, again, the pain levels are growing. Nothing works. Small business programs don't work. Training programs don't lead anywhere because there are no jobs. Bring in some big corporation with a big tax benefit. They come in for a little while, take the benefit, and then run, leaving people high and dry. The people understand that. And in cities like Cleveland and many others, there's Oakland, California, and there's cities even in Texas, we have approached people to do this. In Maryland, there are a number of cities considering, Atlanta's another, Pittsburgh, saying we're at a dead end. We've either got to do something new, and it is this kind that changes the ownership of property and organization to worker ownership co-ops. Either that or just the pain continues. So we're seeing that process. When I called the book a toolkit, America Beyond Capitalism, it's like saying here are the things that most people don't know what's going on the ground because the press doesn't cover it. There are thousands of things like this that are being developed in different parts of the country, and some of that's reported on in the book. But Cleveland is the most interesting and most advanced, but it's built up, and this is the hard point, it's built on people who have been working for 10, 20 years laying down experience and then capturing it, and then advancing in a big way once the moment is right. So I sometimes say to people, you want to change the system? You don't start unless you're talking about decades. This is the most powerful corporate capitalist system in the history of the world. It's very important to do political challenges, very important to raise consciousness, but to rebuild that system means starting from the bottom, as well as the ideas of when the next crisis happens, there'll be some public takeovers, having a vision and being willing to stick with it year in, year out, building in the kind of process in Ohio that has led to this stage and beyond, in my opinion, it's going to go well beyond because many other people are thinking about how to take it further. So I'm afraid that's a long, long answer to your question. But it's if you look at it as a historian, that's very exciting. My heroes are the civil rights workers in the 1930s and 40s, the people who laid down the groundwork when it looked very much harder, that then became the 60s explosions. And that's how I think about the history of this time. They're laying down the groundwork, so we've got something really that we understand that's different from state socialism or corporate capitalism, that we've actually built the knowledge and the experience for a different vision that also alters and democratizes the ownership of the system. So that's what America Beyond Capitalism is about. It's about that process and also kind of reporting on what's going on that the press simply doesn't cover.
And the book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. My guest through the end of the hour is Gar Alperovitz, who is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative. And I want to talk a little bit more about those points, but I first want to take another caller who's holding patiently on the line. And hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hello, Norm. Earlier in the program, you kind of lumped Cuba and the Soviet Union as failed economic entities. And to my mind, that's not quite right. In the face of both the collapse of the Soviet Union and the 50-year enmity of the United States, Cuba is still there as a planned economy. And to me, it's more like a miracle than a failure. And they even got rid of a whole bunch of people we would consider criminal and criminally insane and just insane in the Mariel boat lift, which was kind of a trick, I guess. But basically, you, Norm, agree with the late Professor George Marcy, who taught that socialist islands cannot long exist in a capitalist sea. And there seems to be an exception to that rule, and it's called Cuba.
Okay.
What do you think, Norm? Can you expand?
I will.
What you were thinking?
I apologize for speaking in shorthand there, and I don't want to steer this conversation elsewhere, but what I said was the planned economy of the Soviet Union or Cuba before the special period. And I think that what I'd like to do at some point, and probably on another program, is go into sort of an analysis of what happened with the special period in Cuba and what changes were made and what you're seeing now in terms of urban agriculture, in terms of a change in the way markets are done, is very different from the Cuba when it was in, and I'm going to at risk say this, in an almost colonial relationship with the Soviet Union, where they were producing sugar, sending it to Eastern Europe and trading it for canned tomatoes from Bulgaria. But I think that's a whole other program, and I don't want to go there. But Gar Alperovitz, do you have anything to add on that point or to correct me on?
Well, no, I agree with you. It's a long discussion, but I think the central point I was trying to make is that the models that we know about that were highly centralized and were undemocratic really need to be challenged intellectually by people who are on the left and are progressives and come up with a vision that actually makes sense and is very American in its roots. And what I'm kind of urging in America Beyond Capitalism is that the ingredients for that are available to us on the ground and in the ideas, and that we can build from that if we actually look below what the press normally covers and roll up our sleeves and get to work.
Now, the caller mentions the late Professor George Mossy here at the University of Wisconsin, and his statement, you can't have a socialist island in a capitalist sea. I worked here in a co-op in Madison for many years where we said something similar. We said you can't build socialism in one co-op. Your discussion of the Cleveland model shows a different approach, which is kind of integrating these different cooperative entities together in a system and connecting that to a larger system. One example that you do mention in the book, and I'd like to go into a little bit of another way, is the bank, the state bank of North Dakota, because suddenly, again, you take this capital out of the control of rich speculators, basically, and put it in the hands of a publicly elected entity.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let me just mention, George Mossy was a wonderful professor of mine when I was at the University of Wisconsin, a wonderful, wonderful man, but I didn't agree with everything he said. What has changed, and why I think possibilities are opening up at many different levels, is that the pain levels are deepening. There would not have been such a public response to the Occupy if people didn't know that something was fundamentally wrong, profoundly wrong. That's the beginning point, and that's a big deal in history when that idea begins to be, hey, there's something really wrong here. In that context, the kind of activism and politics and organizing and developing different institutions is much different from when I went to school at the University of Wisconsin, when these ideas and when George Mossy taught me those ideas, was thinking about it. So that's the premise of the whole argument, that we're in a very different historical time of great pain and difficulty and reassessment. We could go into that at a much greater length, but that's what I would comment. The development in the United States, which is a continental system of an alternative system that both begins locally but also has planning and manages trade so it's not so disruptive, That's very different from a tiny little island dependent for oil on imports and, you know, isolated off the coast of the United States. So I don't know how we compare those, but I am certain that this gigantic and very rich system, producing almost $200,000 a year, even now, just a little under for every family of four, you could manage this system in a way that was wonderfully productive if we began to get control, democratic control of the decisions and the investment power. The state bank issue is really another interesting one. North Dakota's had that state bank there since the early part of the 20th century, and 15 states have now considering legislation again to do the same thing. That's another place where, again, you can take action to begin to say, hey, why can't we do that here, and then use the funding to develop alternative institutions, to develop green and ecologically sound economic strategies. Cities are beginning that, too. I just saw that San Francisco, one of the councilmen, has proposed they have a $2 billion in city assets, city funds each year. Why give it to Bank of America? Why not set up either a credit union or a public bank and then use the funds in a different investment way to rebuild the parts of the city in a new way, like Cleveland? I've heard recently, but I haven't seen the documentation, that Portland has Portland, Oregon, has very similar ideas, and these can be done almost any place. What I find is people don't know what's on the ground because the press simply doesn't cover it. And once you see what other people are doing elsewhere, you can say, hey, why can't we do that here? I mean, you know, we walk on the same two legs they do. If it can be done in Portland or if it can be done in North Dakota, why not here? And then it becomes a matter of political activism and engaged building and process, you know, the hard work that goes into building a political movement and building an economically intelligent political movement as well. But the ingredients are there, and the time is painful, and the awareness that something new is necessary. I think that all is the presence of opening up a different vision and building forward, including knowledge that there will be other crises at the national level, which may raise questions about some of the very large industry simultaneously.
The book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. My guest, Gar Alperovitz, we only have about 2 minutes left, so much more to talk about here. But just briefly, you've talked about the long view, looking at building history a step at a time. And yet we have on the other side the people who are trying to roll history back to the 1800s, probably, the group ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, writing legislation that's being adopted in state houses across the country. We have the control of the media that you've mentioned, or at least touched on a couple of times, by corporate interests. We have the campaign finance issues that were exacerbated by the Citizens United decision. How do we, these small cooperative movements, respond to this money that's being dumped in trying to roll back every gain that we can possibly make?
Well, I mean, we do it the way we always do it. That's always the lineup. You know, if you were in the South in the 1940s and the 1930s, the lineup was much worse than what you just described, because the lineup meant that if you got out of line, they'd hang you from a tree. Much tougher penalties. So the way it's done is the way it's always done. Roll up your sleeves, grassroots organizing, grassroots development of new institution building, a vision of where you want to go, a sense of why the pain levels are going to bring other people along because they're going to have to do something different or the pain will continue, and a strategy to move from here to there. I would not underestimate the opposition, but, you know, just speaking as a historian, revolutions are as common as grass in world history, and they come about for the obvious reason that the powers that be continue to frustrate and increase the pain levels of ordinary people, and at some point, over time, they explode, or they develop, or they do both. So that's where it is, and I think the question is, what's on the ground are the ingredients that can be built up, and the ideas are beginning to develop, and the question is now, we're at the beginning point, not the end point of a long, long evolutionary reconstructive process. It is possible that nothing can be done. It's possible it will lead to violence and fascism. And it's also possible, and this is the only one worth working for, that either we lay the foundations for a fundamental transformation, or we build forward in ways that improve people's lives step by step, no matter what. And I choose the latter path, with some sense that, you know, We've looked at these games before. When I was at school in Wisconsin, Joe McCarthy made it impossible to do anything, and then the 60s exploded.